Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 5th, 2013. Today's show is all about life on the job. First, how to get one. We have tips for a killer interview. Hint, choose your outfit carefully.
You're wearing tuxedos to a job that requires you to clean bathrooms. Please leave this office. We're done with this interview.
Do we get any sort of souvenir?
Get out of my office!
Also, should your resume reveal your race? The hiring process can tread on some very sensitive ground.
So you not gonna give me the job just because I'm black?
Okay, first of all, you just walked into the room, so the interview hasn't started.
And the crime scene better known as the office kitchen.
Someone at work ate my sandwich.
Well, what did the police say?
What missing food and dirty dishes say about workers and management. All this just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. A new jobs report is just in, and the numbers are disappointing. The economy only added about 88,000 jobs last month, well below the 190,000 economists were predicting. And the unemployment rate slid just a tad down to 7.6%. The bottom line, the labor market recovery seems to have lost some steam in March. But looking back at the year so far, we have seen some big jumps in healthcare and in professional and business services, which means more Americans are moving into offices around the country. Whether that means a cubicle or a corner suite, you can't get around it. The office is a huge part of American life. Most workers spend at least half of their waking hours in the office every day. So let's spend some time talking about the workplace. Now, these days, I'm a freelancer, so I need a guide when it comes to offices. I've asked Ramit Sethi to join me. He's a personal finance advisor and author of the bestseller, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. He's going to start us off by helping us get through the door, and I'm talking about the art of the interview. Thanks for joining us today, Ramit.
Thank you.
Now, you have made a huge promise to us today that you can teach anyone how to interview better than 99% of the people in the world.
Well, that is correct, and the bar isn't very high. Most people go into an interview and they do many things wrong. So we can get very far in just today's segment.
Okay, what are those 99% doing wrong?
Okay, they walk in, and the number one mistake we make when we go in for a job interview is believing that an interview is all about answering questions.
And no, it's about creating an impression.
It's about creating a narrative and communicating your key messages.
Communicating your story.
Mm-hmm. You want to know your three key talking points. And whatever they ask you, of course you want to answer that in your interview, but you also want to communicate your key messages. So for example, you might want to communicate one talking point that says, I'm the creative designer who also has a background in analytics. And so when they ask you a question about, tell me about your background, you're going to make sure to communicate that key point.
Where do most people go wrong?
So 80% of the work is done before you ever walk into that interviewing room. So the research that we do is what makes us the best at interviewing. For example, if you've done your homework, you know what the key challenges of that company are. You also know what that role entails and who they work with. So you start using the words that the company uses. And all of a sudden, that interviewer, his or her eyes are going to light up.
And now you start having a conversation as opposed to an interview.
Exactly.
Okay, so you nailed the interview and you got an offer. But they want you to name a salary figure first. This seems to happen all the time. What do you do?
Don't do it. It's not your job to name the salary. Let them name it first. And I'm going to give you the exact phrase you can use.
Okay, I have my pen. Go ahead.
So you can say, you know what? I'm sure that we can find a number that works for both of us. I'm very interested in the position, and I would love to know how I can contribute to the organization. Let them make the first move. People chronically short themselves. Mm. I've had people who I've hired. I was willing to pay them $10,000 more, and they came at me with a lower number. I said, sure, welcome on board.
Well, I think people feel insecure because the employer usually knows what you were getting paid at your last job.
Well, you shouldn't reveal that either. If they ask you in the middle of an interview, what were you paid or how much do you want to be paid? You say, you know what? I'm sure we can figure out the money later, but right now I just want to figure out if this is a good fit for you and if this is a good fit for me.
What about benefits? These days in such a tight hiring market, are those negotiable as well?
Of course. A lot more things are negotiable than you think. I've had people who work for me negotiate all kinds of benefits, work from home, meet for a quarterly lunch, etc. And of course, because I wanted them, I was way more willing to negotiate with them.
These are all so easy to say. It's so hard to go in there with the confidence that you need to come out with this kind of language.
And that's why 80% of the work in a negotiation is done before you ever walk in the room as well. So you want to be practicing your negotiating skills before you ever sit down with that interviewer.
Okay, so you land the job and you get settled. I imagine you should start networking pretty soon after that, right? Because nothing is sure anymore.
What I like to do, and I recommend this to my students, as soon as they enter a new job, pick a list of people that work at that company and have at least 2 lunches a week with other people in your company. No agenda, no items. Just say, you know what? I just started working here. I've heard great things about you. I'd love to know what you do and how you got to this position.
And how do you help the introverts among us to accomplish this?
You know, it can be really uncomfortable. You're going to meet someone much more experienced than you. You don't know what to say. It's okay to actually say, do you mind if I pull out a few questions? I prepared them ahead of time. I know I'm a little nervous. People love that. And it's okay to bring your own questions to the table. It just shows that you're prepared.
Well, that's great. Thanks so much, Ramit.
Thank you.
By the way, Ramit's graciously agreed to stick around this hour. He's got some tips for us about how to get a raise and how to handle career change later on in the show. So stay tuned for that.
Dip, 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 dip.
The first contact most job seekers have with their potential employer is, of course, the resume. And that's where things can go very wrong, right from the start. Take the case of Veronica Wells. While she was looking for her first job after college, a career counselor told her to remove any mention of her membership with the National Association of Black Journalists. Veronica couldn't believe her ears. She left it in. She did end up getting a job. She's now the associate editor of the culture website MadameNoir.com, and she's written an article for the site about her resume experience. Veronica, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you guys.
Well, tell us about this conversation you had with a career counselor about race and your resume. What was her concern?
Her concern was, and she was a fellow Black woman, but her concern was that if I was trying to get a job, some places would be hesitant to hire me or might see that I listed that I was involved in a Black organization or African-American organization and would maybe not hire me because of that. So it was just shocking. And I didn't shut it down immediately. I just kind of nodded. And when I went back and thought about it, I was kind of like, you know what, this is not really what I'm about, you know, hiding who I am, such a big part of who I am. And then I thought, you know, do I really want to work for a company who would not hire me based on race?
So ultimately, you decided to leave in your membership with the National Association of Black Journalists on your resume.
I did.
But would you always keep that on your resume or other references that signal your race, no matter what company you were applying to or what position you were seeking?
I definitely would. Like, NABJ has been such an integral part in my career path. And so I kind of feel like it would be almost a slap in the face to then turn my back on the organization or not be proud to list that on my resume when it's helped me get where I am today.
Well, I'd like to bring in our second guest. We also thought that hearing from a career counselor would be a good idea. Virginia Clark is president and CEO of Talent Optimization Partners based in Chicago, and she joins us now. Welcome, Ginny.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
How often do you hear stories like Veronica's?
Pretty often. Unfortunately, that it's still a concern, but I share and would support her decision. I think you made the right call, Veronica.
Well, thank you.
Well, so many workplaces now say they're committed to diversity in their hiring practices. So I would imagine that racial or ethnic minority candidates are more likely to feature their backgrounds rather than smokescreen them.
Yeah, I see both because diversity continues to be an issue. Now, you can still question whether or not people are giving lip service, but at least many of the corporations, large ones that I speak to, they're trying to identify diverse candidates. So that's part of the reason I encourage people to list it. It doesn't guarantee you anything, but it might get you a second look.
Well, it's not just race, right? There's sexual orientation and religion and, you know, gender. All can be used to discriminate against a potential employee or to fill quotas, either one.
It cuts both ways.
Right. And there are laws in place designed to counter this. But how do companies that operate under these EEOC laws typically approach diversity efforts within these legal parameters?
Typically, they can't ask, but you can certainly offer, and it becomes part of kind of your unspoken record. So they have to be very careful as to what they're writing down and what they might put in front of a hiring manager.
Well, Ginny, have you ever had a client where you said, well, perhaps you do want to neutralize your resume when it comes to religion or race or ethnic background?
Religion would probably be more of a sensitive issue. GLBT still, unfortunately, might be something that people downplay. As a recruiter, I did work for some religious organizations and had to make sure that they understood that the candidates that I was going to show them were going to be from a variety of religious backgrounds. And so they, you know, I was hoping that they would be sort of agnostic, so to speak.
Veronica, does this resonate with you? And I know that many people responded to your article.
I was kind of surprised by the response that we received. A lot of people were saying, well, you know, she wasn't wrong in the advice that she gave you. And then other people were saying, well, you know, I have a name that is what people would say stereotypically Black or ethnic or an ethnic name. And so, you know, I put my initials on the resume.
You were applying within the field of journalism. Ginny, how much does it matter what job or what company you're targeting?
I think it matters a lot, actually. I love Veronica's example of a name. You know, kind of sad to say that I know that sometimes people make judgments. I've done exercises with recruitment teams that will say they are making a snap judgment and based on the name, based on the resume and many, many other factors. In some ways, there's even a class consideration if your name is not of, if it's pronounceable or if it's something that might be perceived as made up or if it's from a completely different language and culture.
Okay, Jenny, I'm going to out you as an African-American now.
Yes, please.
Marketplace.
That's absolutely. That's fine. I'm proud of that.
Have you ever had to make the choice that Veronica had to make?
No, I have not. I have always let people know that I'm African-American. I'll throw in another factor. And I know we're talking about resumes, but, you know, after the resume and you make it through the screen, then you got to show up.
Right.
It's a slow slide until you come in for the interview. And then it's like, OK, bam, she's Black. She's a woman.
I'm very clear. On my resume, you'll see that I was part of the Kellogg Black Management Association. There are so many signals on my resume. There's no way that you wouldn't know.
And why do you signal it?
It's part of who I am. It speaks to how I think. It speaks to what's important to me. There's some self-selection that goes on here. You know, I want to be with an organization that is going to value all of me, including my ethnicity, my race. You know, I don't want to work for an organization that wouldn't want me to bring my whole self to work.
Ginny Clark is president and CEO of Talent Optimization Partners. Veronica Wells is associate editor of MadameNoir.com, where you can read her article, Is Your Resume Too Black? Thank you so much, both of you, for talking with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Tech companies like Google get a lot of attention for the free food they offer their employees. And business gurus have found that food perks and breaking bread together is the easiest way to build worker morale. But judging by the countless blogs dedicated to slamming office kitchens, most companies don't seem to get it. Sadly, the office kitchen is usually a place that's rarely cleaned, often looted, and almost always a bit depressing. And here at Marketplace? Well, let's see.
The office kitchen. The office kitchen.
Oof, it's usually filthy. I keep it clean, that's all I gotta say.
The sink is full of dirty dishes. They leave them there till it becomes an experiment of some sort.
I think we're busy people who sometimes put the oatmeal bowl in the sink and forget that we put it there to let it soak.
Have you ever seen the end of The Last Terminator? There was a complete wasteland. When I open the fridge, that's what I think of. And it smells like New York.
I've actually gotten to the point where I purchased plastic utensils and it's worth the cost of not having to even go near the kitchen.
The refrigerator is a federal Superfund site. Frankly, nobody should go into it without the full bodysuit.
Oh, come on, guys. It's not that bad, is it? But do the dirty dishes and moldering leftovers say something about us and our workplace culture? Ben Dattner has put some thought to this. He's an organizational psychologist and also author of The Blame Game, How the Hidden Rules of Credit and Blame Determine Our Success or Failure. And Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here. So tell me, can you organizational types learn anything significant about a company culture from the office kitchen?
Absolutely. So in too many office kitchens, it's abandoned, it's desolate, and when you open the fridge, it looks like kids are conducting science experiments in the fridge.
And what do you read from that?
People don't have a sense of ownership over the workplace, that they don't care, that they don't invest enough in it. So former Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers, in talking about home ownership, said, in the history of the world, nobody has ever washed a rented car. And so if people are not washing the kitchen in their workplace, it means that they see themselves more as renters than as owners. It means that they feel transitory, that they're passing through. They don't have a real psychological contract with the company, with the space, with the workplace. And that's a problem.
How about those refrigerators full of food labeled by name and warnings? And I'm speaking of the marketplace kitchen now. Do not touch upon peril of death.
Well, it's a real evolutionary arms race between the stealers of food and the protectors of food. So both sides resort to extreme measures. In some cases, there are actually some products on the market where you can buy a bag that is laced with fake mold so that people are dissuaded from stealing your lunch. In an ideal workplace, there should be enough people in and around the communal spaces that people won't even be tempted to drink one another's milk or eat one another's lunch.
In terms of different personality types and how you can read who employees are by the state of their kitchen, what do you think about people constantly bringing in food to share?
Well, it could be sometimes someone considers him or herself to be sort of a den mother or a den father, somebody who provides for everyone, who brings everyone together. So that can be a positive thing. On the other hand, sometimes people who are underperforming think that they can ingratiate and justify their poor performance by being a good cook.
So a sign of insecurity.
A sign of insecurity or an attempt to get special treatment. Organizations also face the dilemma of, if there are violators, do we try to resort to guilt and to conscience, or do we try to resort to shame? And some of those exhortational post-it notes and letters and emails that people send out try to get towards guilt and shame as a motivator. I think it's a dilemma, though, for anybody who is upset about what's going on in the kitchen. On one hand, you want to say, everyone, please clean up after yourself. On the other hand, if you send out exhortations like that, people might come to realize that the norm is to be irresponsible rather than the exception to the norm. So, for example, psychological studies have shown that when you're visiting a hotel, if you believe that other people don't ask their towels to be washed, are willing to have their bedding stay on the bed for an extra day or two, if you believe that the norm is that people do that and you have to opt out of it, you're actually more likely to be environmentally responsible. So similarly, I think it's a dilemma in the workplace. If somebody lets it be known that there is frequent violation, it might paradoxically cause people to be more likely to violate rather than less likely.
I am so overwhelmed. I don't think I'll ever walk into the office kitchen and just get my lunch out of the refrigerator again. Ben Dattner is an organizational psychologist and a professor at New York University. Ben, thanks so much for this.
Thank you. It was great to be with you, and I'm off to get my lunch.
And if you're still curious about the state of our kitchen, you can visit marketplacemoney.org for a look at our fridge. And we'd love to see pictures of your workplace kitchen, disgusting and otherwise. You can post them on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Ramit Sethi is back with us now to continue our investigation of life at the office. Ramit is the author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and one of the ways that he delivers on that promise is by advising people how to get a raise. Now, there are right and wrong ways to go about the actual negotiation process, but Ramit will tell you that everything depends on the initial approach you take. And thanks for sticking around, Ramit.
Great to be here.
All right, this is stressful stuff. I already feel myself tensing up. And it's stressful, especially during the economic downturn when most employers are sticking to this, 2.5% cost of living increase. So first off,
How do you decide when it is an appropriate time to ask for a raise? Economy be damned.
You always want to know what your value is. And you can do that in a variety of ways. You can go online. There are great websites like payscale.com, salary.com. You can type in your information there, and you'll find out what people like you are earning.
It's always a very widespread, though.
Yes, of course. And so you want to do it on multiple sites, and you start getting ranges. I find that with my students, when they do this research, on average, you're not going to believe this, they find out they're underpaid by over $12,000.
Wow.
It's a staggering number.
Yeah, I am surprised. Yeah.
So all of a sudden they say, wait a minute, someone else who gets hired and negotiates their salary is getting paid $12,000 more than I am? That's outrageous.
Okay. All right. So you do your research. Let's say you decide you're worth at least $5,000 more. Okay, I want $5,000. I walk in the room. I say, hi, Patty Hirsch, senior producer of Marketplace Money. I'm here to talk about a raise. What next?
Okay, that's actually what most people believe asking for a raise is about. That's why we get so anxious. We think we're going to walk in the room, demand a raise, and of course, what's the first thing your boss is going to say? They're going to say, no.
What, are you nuts? I haven't even had coffee yet.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually like to take a much longer approach and show how I can add value to the organization before I ever ask for a raise.
Okay, what do you mean by the long approach?
So I like to start thinking, if possible, 3 to 6 months ahead of time. So I'll go into a meeting with my boss, and I'm not going to talk about money. Instead, I'm going to talk about how I can make their lives easier. So I'm going to say something like this. I'm going to say, you know what? I want to become a top performer at this company. I really want to outperform everybody and make your life easier and help the company grow. These are the things I think would be most important. Do you agree? And they're going to say, yes, no, you should change this. And you say, okay, great. And then a key phrase you can use is you say, you know what? I want to ask you one other thing. If I do these things, if I do an extraordinary job, I'd like to discuss a salary adjustment later on. But for right now, I just want to focus on getting these things done.
So it's important to tip your hand that way?
Remember, you're not saying, can you give me more money? You're using a very strategic phrase, adjust my salary. And so, of course, a boss is going to say, okay, we can have that discussion down the road because you're committing to something now, but you're not asking them for money right now.
Although it's also quite possible they'll just say, look, if you're looking for a raise, you know, no one's getting a raise this year.
Absolutely possible. But once you do these things, if you, let's say you cut costs by 4% or you raise revenues by 3% by doing some optimization on the website or whatever it may be, it becomes very difficult to say no when you have a top performer in your organization.
So you're putting a whole new spin on proactive.
You have to deliver before you go in and ask. Otherwise, why would they give you more money?
Great. Should you go in when you finally do go in and ask? And should you go in with documentation of
Yes.
everything you've done and what an incredible employee you are?
Absolutely. So before I walk in, I want to send them status updates every couple weeks or every month saying, this is what we talked about. Things are going really well. We were able to find some areas to cut costs in, et cetera. By the time you walk in, there should be no surprise about what the discussion is going to be. You say, 3 months ago, we discussed these things. I just wanted to show you an update. We were able to do X, Y, and Z. And so we also discussed a possible salary adjustment. I'd like to talk about that now with you.
Okay, because I always like to think in terms of worst possible case scenarios. How can you mess it up at this point, given that you've done all of these prior steps?
I like the way you think. So you can mess it up by not sending status updates. Nobody, no boss wants to get blindsided with having their employee walk in and ask for money. Not a good situation.
So uncomfortable.
Very bad. The second thing you can do is be very unconfident. Imagine I walk in and say something like this. So maybe I was hoping that you could possibly somehow give me some more money. What are they naturally going to say? No, we don't have the budget. But if you walk in and you're confident, here's what I've done. Here's what other top performers like me are being paid. It's very hard to resist that.
Should you be ready to walk?
You always want to know how much you're worth. And if that means evaluating other offers and opportunities, of course. But I don't like to walk in and put a gun to the boss's head. Nobody likes that, especially if you're going to be working with them for a long time. So in the back of your head, of course, do your research. But I really don't like to walk in and put people on the spot.
Is there a final phrasing that you would recommend for people when they get turned down? It's just the answer is no. We just can't hack it this time.
You always want to prepare for plan B. Sometimes the organization just really doesn't have the money, or perhaps your boss is just not willing to do it. So what I like to say in those cases is, look, I understand times are tough. I understand we may not have the budget right now. I'm going to continue being a top performer, but what I'd like to ask is that we do a re-review 6 months from now. Get them to commit to at least that. And if they're not willing to even do that, you may want to start looking at other opportunities.
So leave a door open.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. And while we're talking about work, why don't we answer one of our listener letters this week? Michelle is on the line from New Orleans. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, what's your question for Ramit?
Sure. So about 7 months ago, I and my boyfriend moved down here for my job. I recently started a new career with the plan that he would continue school and work part-time. But we found that he had a really hard time finding a part-time gig. And we moved from Silicon Valley, where everything is very internet-centered, to New Orleans, where things are a little bit different. And so I was worried that that's part of the reason he was having trouble, was that he was sort of looking for customer service, retail, food service type jobs, but was really relying heavily on the internet. And I wanted to know if, you know, in most of the country, does it really make sense to search for those kinds of jobs in that manner? Or should you be out there on the pavement like, you know, like I did when I was a teenager or whatever?
Can I back up for a second? What does your partner want to do long term with his career?
So long term, he's in school to become a teacher, but in order to get there, he needs to earn money in the meantime, and so that's why he was looking for, you know, something more short term and part term or part time.
Huh? What do you think of that, Ramit?
Well, if the short term need is just to make some money, then I think that that's fine. I think you always want to consider: is this job going to have a long term potential for me? Sounds like he's on his path towards being a teacher. That's fine. Typically, you know, when you see people going into retail, either they end up staying there a long time or, and this is what I prefer, they have a short-term plan why they're doing it. They need some short-term income, and then they want to move themselves out of a job and into a career.
Right.
Your question, though, was, does it make sense, should he be pounding the pavement or thinking online? And I'm just picturing New Orleans right now, spring, right?
Right.
A beautiful time to be
it
out and
lovely.
About. Ramit, what do you think about that?
So I have a very strong opinion on this. And most people who are starting their job search, they take the easy route. They go online to these job search sites, they submit their resume, and they wipe their hands clean saying, well, I submitted my resume, and they wait as if the jobs are going to fall from heaven. That doesn't work anymore.
Well, most people never hear anything at all. That's why, Michelle, I was really surprised to hear you say that most of your professional life you have done everything online.
Well, I mean, in my case, I just started work as an assistant professor. And so, you know, it's the sort of thing where it's a national search. And so you kind of start that process online. Like, you know,
and it's very hierarchical and very prescribed, right?
Exactly. In which case, it kind of makes sense. And so that's why I was concerned. I was like, you know, I think the online search made sense for me, but I feel like for what you're searching for, but, you know, you you don't always want to actually say that. And so that's why I wrote in, was just to see whether or not my instincts were right on that.
Yeah. So, Michelle, I'm gonna share something from the other side of the table. I recently hired someone for a position that I had open. I mentioned it on my website. I got over 400 applicants in seven days, which tells you, and I'll be totally candid here, I gave each applicant about 15 seconds of time. That's what I could afford. In
fact, did you learn from 15 seconds?
I'll tell you what. I had one question in there that was really the key question, and I went straight to that question, and anyone who had the right answer got put into the second pile. And this isn't just me. I'm not just a mean guy. Almost all hiring managers give you 10 to 15 seconds when they look at your resume.
Wait, what was the key question?
The key question was, it was a customer support head position. And I said, how would you improve retention? So it was a bit of a technical question. And I wanted to see if they had experience, they would use the right keywords and they would understand the concepts. If they simply said, I want to make everybody happy, that wasn't the person for me. So Michelle, back to your question. Online is... You know, it seems to make sense, but everyone else is doing that. So instead, I would recommend pounding the pavement, as you said. That means going out, meeting people who work at these companies. So find out who works there and just say, you know what, can I take you out for 10 minutes of coffee? I just love to ask you a couple of questions. You say, how'd you get the job? What is this company like? What kind of people are they hiring? By the time you go in to walk in for an application, you can walk in and say, you know what, I spoke to Jeff. He had great things to say about this company, and I'm very prepared. I would love to work here. It puts you head and shoulders above everyone else applying for that job.
Michelle, are we talking bartending and actually restaurant work?
Really? I mean, I think initially he was very much thinking more sort of entry-level administrative, clerical type works. He had done a little bit of that before, but then a point came where it was just like a job. Like anything would be good. And so actually the good news is that since I initially wrote in, he actually did manage to find a job, and it was funny because it ended up kind of being a combination of the two, where we initially found the job online, but we actually had a relationship with the organization, and so we were able to able to craft the application and all that to help ensure that he made it to that next step.
So you knew somebody?
Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear. I'm so glad to hear it worked out. But I hope Ramit's suggestions will work for you in sometime in the future.
Absolutely. No, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
And as always, we love to hear from you. You can tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank or post on our Facebook page. And you can go to marketplacemoney.org. Look around the office and think, you might as well be surrounded by a bunch of monkeys? No, of course you don't. You never. But believe it or not, some businesses are finding guidance and even inspiration in the world of chimps and other primates. Chester Zoo in England has started opening its cages to local businesses so they can observe the behavior of the chimpanzees and take what they learn back to their boardroom. Katie Prescott of the BBC has the story.
At Chester Zoo in the north of England, a chimp hurls himself at the thick pane of glass that separates him and me. I wonder what he's trying to tell me. The biologist behind the course, Patrick Van Veen, gives people attending a more restrained reception.
Thank you this morning for coming here to Chester Zoo. My name is Patrick Van Veen. I'm going to take you in this workshop.
The course aims to show how watching a chimp's behaviour can help you better understand your colleagues. Dutch company Ape Management is behind the idea and runs sessions in zoos across Europe. And for around $2,000, businesses can send a group of their workers to learn about their ape ancestors' instinct and see how they mirror our own. For example, how we make friends with people, or how we react when we're jealous, or how we try to take charge of a group. Founder Van Veen was inspired to set up the business 10 years ago by his own boss.
He was about 2 meters tall, he was huge, and he had small glasses, and always when you entered his office, he stared at you and said, okay, what are you coming to bring to me?
You just leant towards me and I sort of leant back. What sort of behaviour do you see in the primate world that you think applies in the business world?
There is a lot of behaviour. Like, sometimes it's good to make people also aware about the way they show dominant behaviour and how that reflects on the people in their group. But it's also about grooming. We spend a lot of time in just this chit-chat, drinking coffee with each other, and that's grooming behavior like primates do. That's building relationships.
Van Veen's original client base was from the insurance industry, where he started his career. It's now branched out into all sectors, with a client list including accountancy firm PricewaterhouseCoopers and oil giant Shell. So what do the businesses who visit the zoo make of bringing biology to the boardroom? Sandra Bruce works for British bank NatWest and says she learned a lot from the day.
One of the things that I really took away was how, when we see different behaviours, how we really put those into categories instead of just watching the behaviour and understanding the behaviour.
So what do you think you'll take away from it into your workplace?
It's really about sort of observing people more and not immediately sort of putting them into little cliques, if you like, but understanding the behaviours and what that means. The organisation is about people and they're the most important part, so it's really understanding the people that work for you.
And did any of the monkeys remind you of anyone in your organisation?
They did, but I'm not telling you who.
Well, the training's gone down well with the companies that have taken part, but is the science sound? Sonia Hill is a research officer at Chester Zoo, specialising in animal behaviour.
We see things like dominance displays, we'll see posturing, we'll see submissive behaviour where animals move out the way of each other just in the same way that we might try and avoid certain people sometimes.
Now the company's hoping to expand its courses from Europe to the other side of the Atlantic and give more workers an opportunity to find out who's really King Kong in their office. In London, I'm the BBC's Katie Prescott for Marketplace.
Dominance displays, posturing, submissive behavior? Sound like anything you've seen at the office? Psychologist Meredith Fuller specializes in a certain subset of these behaviors, usually but not limited to women. Behaviors I think we all know rather well. Cattiness, dismissive, snide remarks, clicks and talking behind people's backs. Most of us associate this kind of stuff with high school, but it doesn't end there. It can make your life miserable at work. Fuller's written a new book about this with the eye-catching title of Working with Bitches. She joins us now from Melbourne, Australia. And Meredith, it's great to have you with us.
Hi, great to be here.
Let's talk about your title first, Working with Bitches. It's certainly provocative, but bitch is such a loaded word. Why did you go with that?
Two reasons. One is, everybody knows what you mean when you say, I work with a bitch. So it's a universal word. The other one is that the new bitch is almost a bit of fun. It's like being a bitch can be a positive thing. So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because I'm always skeptical when I hear the word bitch applied in a work context, because it often turns out to refer to a woman who is aggressive and blunt and tough, which are all behaviors that the workplace rewards in men. You know, a tough man would never be called a bitch, but a tough woman gets slapped with that label.
And there's nothing wrong with being very assertive, but I wrote the book for more polite, concerned, earnest women who can't give it back and need a way to deal with the sort of behaviours that are more manipulative and cunning than just being very assertive.
Will you identify different personality types that come under this heading of exhibiting underhanded, passive-aggressive, or even aggressive-aggressive undermining behaviour? Stuff you can't really codify in the company handbook. And one interesting type I think we can all relate to, you identify as the excluder. What is an excluder like?
Okay, her idea is, if you can help me, I'll bother looking at you. If you're no good to me, I'll ignore you. Or if I want to get rid of you, I'll ignore you. You're just invisible. They don't look at you. They don't pass messages on, but they're very cunning. They don't do it in front of their bosses. So if you complain, it looks as though you might be a little bit paranoid or a little bit too sensitive, and yet they're derailing your career.
Oh, I'm thinking Devil Wears Prada.
Yep, absolutely.
I couldn't have been clearer. There you are, Emily. How many times do I have to scream your name?
Actually, it's Andy. My name is Andy. Andrea, but everybody calls me Andy.
I need 10 or 15 skirts from Calvin Klein.
Okay, what kind of skirts do you...
Please bore someone else with your questions.
Nobody does snide like Meryl Streep. But Meredith, what do you do about an excluder?
Well, the joke is normally when someone tries to exclude us, we chase after them. The more we smile, the more we try and engage them in conversation, the more nice we are, you know, the worse they are. They are contemptuous no matter what you do. The trick is to ignore them as well, which is the last thing we think of.
Well, what if they're your boss?
Well, when they're your boss, what you need to work out is what makes them contemptuous. So either they're jealous or they're envious. They see you as a threat. But the other one is, if they don't see you're valuable, make sure a more senior person in the organisation deems you valuable.
It really seems as if in most of these behaviours, low self-esteem lies at the heart of it.
So right, Barb. The other thing that happens is, for a lot of us, we've got fears, anxieties, depressions, worries, and we mask that. So a lot of the bitchy behaviour is because they don't know how to feel good enough. And so they're relying on these overt behaviours, but there's always something they want. So, for example, that micromanaging boss who's always saying, this isn't good enough, do it again, slashing with the red pen. Often it's their anxiety and they feel they're going to mess up. They look at you, and if you're not very neat, that just screams terror for them that something will go wrong, and they're worried that they're not in control. The more they feel in control, the less they have to hassle you. So give them those updates before they ask. make your desk look neat every time they go past, and that helps bring down their anxiety.
Is part of the issue with women in the workplace this tendency to think something along the lines of, oh, why can't we all just get along? You know, that women want to be liked perhaps more than men at work.
And for some men and women, that's true. But we've got mixed motivations, and I think that's what we pick up. And what we notice is that historically women have found they needed to be more sly, surreptitious, cunning, manipulative, and that's what they've been rewarded for. So
right, and been penalized for being forthright.
Exactly. And what I really like, a lot of the young people we're getting through, the more Gen Ys, they're actually saying, oh, blow all of this. Let me be who I am. And part of me is a range of behaviours. And that also allows men to have their range of behaviours. So I'm seeing a massive paradigm shift that's starting to occur where a lot of these old rigid structures are starting to be broken down. But we're still betwixt and between. So it's a very hard time at the moment with what's going on at work because some of us aren't too sure what's happening.
Well, how do men exhibit these alienating behaviors like lying or narcissism or exclusion differently from women? Because, of course, we all do this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. It's whether you're overt or covert. Men are more overt and do it very clearly and plainly. Now, if you catch them out, they'll just keep doing it overtly like it's a game and it's funny. And then at the end of the meeting or the end of the day, it's dropped because it was a game and it's very out there. With the women, they're more selective and they're more able to play it so subtly with, you know, subtle little mutters and murmuring and nonverbal behaviour that a lot of the men don't necessarily engage in. You know, it's more like it is what it is with a lot of men.
Meredith Fuller, the book is Working with Bitches. Meredith, thanks for this.
Oh, that's a great pleasure.
Do you work with an excluder, narcissist, or a liar? Those are three of the eight unsavory workplace types Meredith identifies. And you can find the others and also get some ideas on what you can do about them at marketplacemoney.org. Let's see. So far on our show today, we've tackled resumes and race, negotiating a raise, mean girls at work, the horrors of the office kitchen, and how monkeys have something to teach us about office politics. Why don't we go out on a high note? Something happy about work. And what could be more positive than getting your dream job? We've been holding Ramit Sethi hostage until he gave up his secrets on how to achieve this. And Ramit, thanks for being our guide to all things work this hour.
Thanks for having me.
So I bet many of our listeners are currently on a job search, given the economy now, and they might be taken aback by this phrase, dream job, especially when it just seems like a miracle if you could get a job. Should job seekers, though, always think in terms of a dream job?
Well, from what we hear in the media, we're lucky to have any job at all. But the fact is that if we spend a little bit of time doing things a little bit differently than most job seekers, it's actually very possible, even in this economy, to get a dream job. I know because many of my students are doing exactly that.
And by different, what do you mean?
Well, what do we normally do when we think of getting a job? The first thing we do is we, quote, update our resume. Then we go online and we send it to thousands of companies.
Oh, that's funny because the first thing I thought of was, what color is my parachute?
We're going back to basics. We're going to be talking about personal relationships, networking, and actually finding the job you want and outperforming every other applicant.
Well, you do have to think about things, though, before you start that networking. You can't just run off in 25,000 different directions, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, I don't recommend people go to networking events because typically you'll find a bunch of other people just like you who are looking for a job. So you don't want to do that. Instead, what I like to do is find the job title and the company that I want to work at. So really doing the work beforehand and then go surgical. Find people who work at that company through LinkedIn or other online sites. Ask them to go out to coffee or have a quick phone call. Typically, they'll actually do it.
You're talking cold calls here.
Cold calls, cold emails. But the best way to do it, obviously, is a warm introduction. That can even happen by saying, hi, Mike, pleasure to see you online. You know, we're both alums of UCLA. I'd love to get 10 minutes of your advice. And people will almost always say yes.
Huh. So take advantage of any kind of connection, as tenuous as it might seem.
Could be college alumni, could be you live in the same city, could be anything you have in common.
So where do people go wrong at this point? You're midway in your networking phase. How do people flub it here?
Number one, it's very demoralizing if you go out and meet 20 people and then you kind of don't know how to turn those meetings into jobs. So it's very important to know the path of what to do next. What I like to do is ask them some questions and say, you know, if I'm interested in this company, what do you recommend would be the best way to go about it? Now, if you come prepared and you ask the right questions, oftentimes they will actually introduce you. And now you're not doing cold calls and competing against everyone else. You have a warm introduction into that company.
Should you be thinking about internships and working for free or for very little, even late in your career?
Usually you don't have to do that if you do this job search process right. And again, that means not submitting your resume through the black hole of doom. That means meeting people personally. Typically, you shouldn't have to work for free in those cases.
How do you know when to cut your losses, though, and settle for less than a dream job?
Well, let's be realistic. Not everyone can get a dream job right now. Okay, that's very fair. But what I like to see is people, even if it's not your dream job, getting a job where you say, look, this is a stepping stone to my dream job. I may not be able to get that dream job today, but after I work at this company for 1 or 2 years, I'm going to have amazing skills and I'll be able to translate that into my second stepping stone, which can be my dream job.
Now, how should you think about personal finance goals in the midst of the dream, the search, you know, salary, retirement age, and all of that?
Of course, have that emergency fund. Of course, be thinking about not only cutting back, which is what so many financial experts talk about, but also earning more. There's a whole subculture now of people who have side jobs. Could be freelance, could be part-time. And that is absolutely critical while you're in the job search.
Well, what if your dream job, though, doesn't match up with your earning potential?
You know what? We have to be realistic sometimes. I have a lot of students who say, I want to be a writer or I want to be an artist, but I want to live in a $1 million house. Something has got to give. So either you say, you know what, I'm going to adjust my expectations, or perhaps you say, my dream job may be to earn more money so that I can live up to those expectations and I'll keep my passion on the side.
So it becomes my dream hobby.
Correct. There's nothing wrong with that. Remember, no. A lot of people go to work, they enjoy what they do, but they keep their passions on the side. That's perfectly fine.
Ramit Sethi's passion and his dream job is his website, IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com. And Ramit, thanks for being such a good sport and spending the whole hour with us.
Thank you.
Ah, weekends, when one usually relaxes. But I just realized you might be working on your taxes. Hey, that rhymes. Which reminds me, it's National Poetry Month. Next weekend on the show, we pay homage to Tax Day with poems and prose submitted by you, our listeners, and thankfully not by me. Some of you have already written in with your lyrical odes to the IRS. Michael Panhorst in Auburn, Alabama, sent in this short poem.
Money now, money later. Stock your IRA, refrigerator.
Benita Cuerda in Van Nuys, California, writes,
as April approaches, I suddenly see the prospect of money leaving me. I saved all my receipts for taxes and such, but I can tell I don't have enough. With medical work and charity giving, I should have spent more. So taxmen, I pray, please get out of my way, for April's the month I most want to avoid. Goodbye to my wealth, I won't see you again, but what can I say but wait till next year?
John Baglio sent in this haiku via Twitter.
Where's my tax refund? The feeling of found money. Sweet self-deception.
Oh, beautiful. Even our own social media mascot, Piggy, got in on the act.
Could do this myself, but tax forms make me nervous, so I pay for pro.
Piggy's not a big fan of rhyming, apparently. But how about you? Think you can do better? Visit us at marketplacemoney.org and send us your poem about taxes. After you finish filing, of course. I think that's enough work for this week of Marketplace Money. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org, or as always, you can get in touch on our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, the housing crisis left many Americans downright scared to own a home. But the American dream isn't exactly dead.
I just want to leave my kids something. I want to have something in my life that I said I accomplished and I did as of right now. I can't say that I can leave them anything.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Ure. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.